The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So today I thought we would explore a bit the quality of dukkha, something I suspect we're all familiar with. It's quite foundational to the teachings of the Buddha. And that's because it's the central axis of the Four Noble Truths, right? They're about dukkha, its arising, its cessation, and the path leading to its cessation. And I know that many people come to Buddhist practice out of some kind of dukkha. Not everybody, but many, myself included. And then we arrive and we hear the first noble truth. Somebody says, there is dukkha. And note that it does not say life is suffering. That's a mistranslation. But there is dukkha in human life. And this can be relieving and gratifying, actually. Finally, somebody is saying it how it is. Yeah. And that, I know for me, that felt kind of honest. It's like, okay, these people are at least provisionally trustworthy because they're saying something honest right from the start. But, we can go beyond this. Dukkha is one of those words that's not very well translated into English by a single word. This is partly just because that happens anyway in a foreign language, right? There isn't always a one-to-one mapping of the ideas. But also, there's a more fundamental reason, which is that even in Pali, dukkha has multiple meanings, or different aspects to it. So even in Pali, it has different shades of meaning. So it has for example, it has a specific meaning of pain. Dukkha can just mean pain, like physical pain even, or mental pain. So for example, in the three kinds of feeling tone, like Vedana, you may have heard of that teaching also. It's said that there's pleasant feeling tone, painful feeling tone, and neither painful nor pleasant. Those are the three kinds. And painful feeling tone is called dukkha vedana, contrasting to sukha vedana, pleasant feeling tone. So literally, it's painful meaning, painful feeling. And that's a narrow meaning of dukkha. That's not the only thing it means, but it can be used that way. And then it has a broader meaning also, which is more like the one in the Four Noble Truths. So this, in this broader form, we sometimes translate it as suffering, but that doesn't really capture all of it. There are other words like unsatisfactoriness, unreliability, stress, struggle, one teacher translates it as. The Pali commentaries say dukkha is that which is hard to bear. And a Thai forest teacher from the last century, Ajahn Mahabua, said dukkha is anything that puts a squeeze on the heart. So these are getting a little bit more creative, but I like all of these because they all capture different aspects of this thing that the Buddha was pointing to as dukkha. So sometimes I'll just say dukkha, and sometimes maybe I'll say something more specific that's appropriate for the context. The direction that the Four Noble Truths aim in is not just to tell you about suffering. They aim toward the cessation of suffering, the end of dukkha. And the Buddha, we are told, eliminated dukkha from his mind and the sources of dukkha. So how did he do that? We might want to know how to do that. And it turns out that he did that through examining dukkha. That's why he put it as the first noble truth, because he wanted us to become aware of it so that we could understand what dukkha is and how it comes about. It's kind of the structural teaching behind the Four Noble Truths is that we turn toward this thing that we all don't want to have. We actually turn toward that which we don't want to have in order that we can understand it. And that's actually the path toward no longer having it in the mind. So the suggestion then, if we step back and say, well, what's going on with that? The suggestion seems to be that we maybe don't understand dukkha fully. If we did, we wouldn't have this problem. So maybe we don't fully understand it. This is a good attitude to start with, is maybe there's something more to be learned here from this aspect of life that is unsatisfactory or painful or stressful. So that's a good, first of all, that's a good approach because it aligns the mind well with being able to approach it. Our usual approach is get rid of it, I don't want it, or deny it. It's not really happening. These are not really adequate approaches. And so we have to be willing to turn toward dukkha. That's sometimes our first act of wisdom, is that we are willing to turn and face it and maybe see something more clearly about what it really is. In fact, right view, the first step of the Eightfold Path, is part of that is to understand that it's worth turning toward dukkha, turning toward what is difficult. And the great thing is that when we do that, that's the beginning of the path to happiness. So that's good news. When the Buddha defines dukkha in the suttas, which he does, on some occasions, it covers a lot of territory, what he says. I'll read a classical definition, actually from his very first discourse, and I'll leave dukkha untranslated, just so we hear it. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, illness is dukkha, death is dukkha. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. Association with what is not dear is dukkha. Separation from what is dear is dukkha. Not getting what one wants is dukkha. Okay, that's clear enough. I think we can all relate to those. And then he sums it up by saying, in short, the five aggregates of clinging are dukkha. What is that? So that suddenly changes a bit. Maybe we don't know what that refers to. That's okay. I'm not actually going to talk about the five aggregates today, but I wanted to read the whole definition. So he points out that the five aggregates of clinging somehow relate to dukkha. So there are going to be these areas. But instead, what I think what we'll take for today from this last sentence is that dukkha has something to do with clinging. That is important, actually. And that we can get, I think, also a little bit. You might have some questions when you first hear that. But let's consider provisionally that it has something to do with clinging, which is something that we're doing, isn't it? So that's interesting from the start. Andrew Olensky has a nice quote about reminding us about this. He says, conventional strategies for human happiness entail various ways of maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain. The problem is that pleasure is not ultimately sustainable and pain is not avoidable. So the shortcoming of our usual approaches is that they treat the symptoms rather than addressing the underlying causes of the predicament, namely that unsatisfactoriness is part of the very fabric of experience. So I think I should qualify that immediately to say that life is unsatisfactory when it is lived in this ordinary, conventional mode of seeking pleasure and avoiding pain. So that when we do it that way, then we will find that unsatisfactoriness is guaranteed because we don't have total control over getting pleasure and avoiding pain, which we can get at an intellectual level. I mean, Has it worked yet? If this is our strategy, how many decades have you been trying to only get pleasure and not have any pain? And maybe we get better at it over time, but 100% of one and 0% of the other, at least for me, that hasn't happened yet. So, and I'm starting to think maybe not. So I think we can sense the grain of truth in what he's saying. So we're going to need a different strategy, right? We're going to need some different approach. And so there's also a suggestion there that dukkha has something to do with how we relate to feeling tone, right? If we're trying to get pleasure and avoid pain, and that's the whole focus. And then we're going to tune our mind toward where's the pleasure? How do I get it? Where's the pain? How do I get rid of it? And if this is doomed to fail, we might have to readjust how we look at feeling tone. So those are also related. So we're starting to get clues just by turning toward dukkha and thinking about that, even just intellectually. We start to get clues about where in our experience we need to start looking in order to develop different strategies. So I want to then talk about three different kinds of dukkha that the Buddha pointed us toward. They're from a little bit later strata of the teachings, but they're nice because they're based on how we relate to the different feeling tones, which I think the feeling tones are very clear. We get pleasure, we get pain, and we get something that isn't really either of those. We can understand that. We can relate to that. So it's helpful to know as we talk about this that dukkha is kind of layered, you know, like there are top level layers, and then there are more subtle layers of each of these kinds of dukkha that I'll be talking about. It's not just one thing. There aren't just three kinds of dukkha, let's say it that way. And they also overlap a little bit. Like it's not like this is meant to be a categorization game. And every time you feel dukkha, you say, oh, is it this one, that one, or that one? That's not quite it. It's more just this is helping us to organize it in our mind so that we can recognize and relate to dukkha more easily. I think there's real nuance to dukkha in my experience as I've turned toward it. We don't actually understand it at a casual glance. So the first kind of dukkha is most easily seen in relationship to unpleasant feeling tone, painful feeling tone. And it's the kind of obvious suffering that we all know. We get it, right? Aging, illness, and death, pain, difficult emotions like sorrow or anger or despair. This is kind of clear and immediate suffering. So, not surprisingly, the Buddha says, yeah, that counts as dukkha. And in fact, he gave it a name that I think you'll appreciate. It's very appropriately called dukkha dukkha. Really, it's called that. That's the kind of dukkha it is. So, does anyone not have experience with this? Okay, so I think we all get that. And then you know, it's not even just personal, right? There are unpleasant aspects of relational life and community life, right? So these are the things about having to associate with people that we don't like, as are some coworkers and relatives we might have to deal with. Or, you know, even the Buddha had to deal with misbehaving monks and a cousin who was trying to kill him. So, you know, there are problems with being a human and living in the human world. And so these kinds of things affect us in a given moment and also across the arc of our life. It's part of the deal of being human is that we get dukkha dukkha. And until we're awakened, this is what's called the predicament, you know, that Alinsky pointed to. But we don't have to make that into a struggle, into a burden, right? So it is helpful. I think I'll just say it up front that physical pain and unpleasant feeling tone in general are not eliminated through awakening. I just pointed toward the Buddha having some cases of this. He also was known to have back pain. Sometimes he didn't give a talk because his back was hurting. But the understanding is also that he didn't suffer for that. So physical pain, this kind of physical pain, does get mitigated through Dharma practice. And that happens because we reduce our mental reactivity too painful feeling tone, right? I said this kind of dukkha is about painful feeling tone. So we might get that first dart of, having a bad back, but then we don't add anything to that. So we start to see, because of when we're thinking about dukkha, we can see that the unsatisfactoriness we feel has something to do with our reactivity. So learning to manage that is part of our practice. So it's easy to think that this is all of dukkha, because that's a lot of what we struggle with is this dukkha. And but it's not all of it, actually. If there's other kinds of dukkha, these two other kinds. So I want to mention them so that you can start to see that those are also present for us and something that we need to work with if we want to get to the cessation of dukkha. So the second kind of dukkha is, the Pali word for it is viparinama dukkha. And you don't need to remember that mouthful, but it's this is most easily seen in relationship to pleasant feeling tone. Can there be dukkha in relation to pleasant feeling tone? And it is, because it's called the suffering of change. And it means that pleasant things are going to end. We know about anicca, right? Impermanence, inconstancy. Pleasant things that we have tend to go away eventually. We can't keep them. We can't hold on to them forever. In fact, this word, viparinama, this is called the dukkha of change, but viparinama doesn't really mean change exactly. That's kind of a neutral word in English. Viparinama means more like degradation or decline or degeneration, also known as aging. Things tend to age and fade and degenerate. Have you noticed this? I mean, anything, your car, your dishwasher, your clothing, over time, things wear out. This is the tendency of things to wear out and break down and fall apart and no longer work. And when they're pleasant things that we like and want and are attached to, this is painful, right? If we really love that dishwasher, or whatever, there's always the one, right? The thing that we buy for a while and we always get it, and then they stop carrying it at the grocery store, or pleasant things end, or they fall apart. And of course, there's the very real ending of people, right? People we love die or age or have dementia. And that is painful for us. So this is also part of dukkha. It can be at a top level. I mean, I remember one time eating a piece of cake and taking smaller and smaller bites as the piece of cake got smaller on the plate, right? So, I'm trying to prolong it, right, subtly. Still, it ended. Nonetheless, it ended. So there's lighthearted ways, but then, also these deeper, heavier ones. And the Buddha said we need to recognize that if we're clinging to pleasant, agreeable, wonderful things, which do happen in human life, we will suffer. So this is points even more clearly to clinging as the culprit. We can cling to pleasant meditation states. It was so silent and peaceful, and then she rang the bell, and then then she started talking. I was having the best sit of my life. I was going to be enlightened in the next moment. Dukkha, even a good sit ends. So Viparinama dukkha highlights the aspect of dukkha that's about unsatisfactoriness or unreliability. Things are great, but then they fade, or we can't keep them. They go away. They fade. Diamonds are not forever. Pleasure is not sustainable. So this is another aspect of dukkha, and it's worth noticing this one too. We've seen this one. And then there's a third one yet. In relation to, we can guess, neutral feeling tone. So this one is most easily seen in relationship to things that are neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And this is called Sankhara dukkha. And as we get more skilled at managing our reactivity to both the painful and the ending of the pleasant. So over time, we get better at managing those. Then we can start to tune into a neutral feeling. This is neither painful nor pleasant. And this has to do with the inherent stress of experience. So let me explain that a little bit since it's kind of subtle. Sankhara, by the way, is a word that also has several different meanings in Pali, and we won't go into all of them, but it basically means the constructive nature of experience, the way that we fabricate our experience in certain ways. We see it in certain ways. We have certain views and opinions and ideas about what's going on, and that's normal. But there is a little bit of stress. Now, the mind has to do all of that activity of knowing what's going on, interpreting it, determining the best response, setting an intention to do things, navigating our life. All of that is something that our mind has to do. It's a little bit of effort to keep all that going. So usually Sankhara dukkha is at a pretty subtle level, and it's not talked about in kind of a macroscopic way. That's why you may not have heard of it. But Joseph Goldstein, so I feel empowered to share this because it's from Joseph. Joseph Goldstein does talk about it at kind of a macro level so that we can understand what's being pointed to. So he says, if you want to think about Sankhara dukkha at an everyday level, you can think about the stress that it takes just to do the mundane things of your life. How much effort every day goes into feeding yourself, clothing your body, washing your body, keeping your space clean, maintaining stuff like getting your car fixed and keeping your calendar up to date and doing your email and all that stuff. That's just like, it's not even a special day. You're feeling pretty healthy, but still you have to do these things to keep your life going. Don't you get tired of all of that maintenance? Maintenance, it's so tiring. I mean, some days it's not so much of a burden, but there are days where it's like, I have to deal with that. It's hard to have a body. And the older you get, the more of those things there are every day that you have to manage, and pay attention to. How much of your attention goes into all of that? If we're lucky, we have a life that allows that. But it's very stressful if our life doesn't quite allow that, and we have to spend, we're trying to earn a living and take care of all of that. So, as many of us are. So, this is kind of the macroscopic pointing towards Sankhara dukkha. But more subtly, this happens in meditation, is that the mind can get very peaceful. Like you can even get into states of deep concentration. There's no dukkha in deep concentration. And it's while it's lasting, there isn't any Viparinama dukkha. It's very stable, very beautiful, very happy. But at some point, the mind tunes into even deep states of concentration are constructed. Even those are something that I'm doing in a sense. And so the classical language is that the mind realizes the stress of rise and fall. And it says, this too is conditioned and volitionally produced. Even this is tiring. So the mind starts to incline toward wondering, how would it be not to construct? What is the mind if it's not making our experience into something? What would that be? This is a very interesting question to ask. And it can point the mind to freedom. Stop constructing. Don't do anything. What would that be like? That's the end of Sankhara dukkha. And if we want all of dukkha to end at some point, that activity itself has to end. So this is a deep exploration of dukkha and pointing toward the different layers of it. We've talked about dukkha-dukkha in relation to unpleasant experience. This is dukkha as suffering. Viparinama dukkha, Dukkha in relation to pleasant experience, the ending of pleasant experience. So this is dukkha as unsatisfactoriness, unreliability. And then dukkha as sankhara dukkha, most easily seen in relation to neutral experience. This is the dukkha as stress, subtle stress of being. So, just to end, we can clarify a little bit the distinction between dukkha as one of these universal characteristics, like what Andrew Olensky pointed to, dukkha as part of the very fabric of experience, and dukkha as the first noble truth that I started with, dukkha as there is dukkha in life. So it is true that all conditioned things are dukkha, in the sense of being ultimately unsatisfying because they're impermanent. But the Four Noble Truths tell us that there is only suffering when there is craving or clinging or pushing away. So only when we're reacting to it, essentially. So I want to read a quote from Ajahn Suwat, one of the Thai forest masters. Is a mountain heavy? It may be heavy in and of itself, but as long as we don't try to lift it up, it won't be heavy for us. So mountains are heavy only if we try to lift them. So yes, all conditioned experience is dukkha, but this is not a problem if we don't cling to it. So that's the way out. We're back to the Four Noble Truths, right? If we end the clinging, then we end the suffering in a fundamental way. So I'll stop there and offering these reflections on different dimensions and different layers of subtlety in this quality of dukkha that we are encouraged to understand in our practice. And ultimately, we're encouraged to find the way out, to find the way to relate to dukkha such that it's not just this conventional, how do I get more of the pleasant and how do I not have the unpleasant? That's a failed strategy. We have to go with the dukkha instead. So I'll stop there and invite your reflections and your questions, comments, your wisdom. I'm sure we all know something about dukkha. And its end. I know something about its end also. Three.
So, in the last couple of weeks, I've had some experiences that are kind of not like when I'm sitting, but I did an online retreat, so I was sitting a lot, and so in between those, which may, some of what you said kind of resonated, and so I'm just kind of reflecting on that. One of them was happened the first time it happened was I was reaching for the phone, and this was during the retreat, and I was reaching for the phone for something, and it was as if I saw like all of the clinging in like some multidimensional HDTV, like I could just see it, I could see what was happening, and I've come to over time I've come to see that in a more muted way, but more consistently. And I've come to sort of think of clinging and aversion as really not two different things. Like it's somehow there's a rejection of the present. Like there's an
Right.
unease, there's a fear, there's some feeling in your stomach, something that's going on, and you're trying to get away from it. And in trying to get away from it, at least for me, I am, even a sitting can be like clinging, like
Right.
sometimes, sometimes it can come from a very deep, like peaceful way, like, okay, and it can rationally it can be the same reason. Like, I'm feeling unease, I want to sit. And some of it can be, I'm feeling unease, I want this to settle down. And I want to examine it. So let me sit. And some of it can be, I'm feeling this unease. I don't want to feel it. I want to sit, you know, like I want to distract myself. I want to sit. And somehow that's magically going to, like, you know, so one of the things is that I've noticed is that.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
The other thing that happened was I was lying on the bed. I have a fair amount of, you know, neck, shoulder, back issues, pains and stuff like that. And so I was lying on the bed and I had this moment, and the first time I had this moment again in like full clarity of somehow it not being mine. Like the pain isn't mine, or the body isn't mine. Like it wasn't a no body sensation. It was just
Right.
like, okay, I'm hearing the words through my ears and I'm hearing a pain through my body. Like it's just another signal and it
Yep.
exists. And it's fine. And I can't tell you, it just felt like suddenly for that moment, like I had been carrying this mountain and I had put it down. And I'm carrying the mountain again afterwards. Like, you know, it's not like
Right.
I've
No, it
stopped
re-arises.
forever. But I had this one moment of just putting the mountain down and just like it was such a heartening, wonderful experience. Oh.
Fantastic. Yeah, and all of experience is still happening, but we just haven't added that extra part about this is me, this is mine. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I think one difference for me is in the past, if I had had an experience like that, there might have been a lot more clinging to reproduce experience, which certainly happened that day, but not in the, like, on a continual basis, not in the same way. It kind of feels like, you know, it'll happen in its own time. It'll, you know, and that experience does come back. And sometimes I'll try to distance myself from the pain, but it's, there's no hurry. There's no.
Yeah, that's right. Because it arose by itself the first time, right? And so actually once you've had that, then you have some momentum to have it again. And it will keep re-arising as needed if we're open to it. I'm glad you're experiencing that. This is wonderful. Thank you. Are there thoughts or questions, comments, observations, objections? Jan.
Get caught in the struggle and meditating of, well, it's trying to find that middle way between showing up and focusing in ways that are helpful and controlling, right? Getting attached to things happening the way I think they should, like calming thoughts or being more in awareness or, you know, just different, being able, not getting lost in thoughts. And then just totally, I mean, the other end of it, there, it's like, and there's like the middle and then there's the end of just totally drifting away, right? It's like, okay, I'm not going to make any effort at all. I'm just going to, and I just get so more caught in the control part of it. No matter how much I know, no matter how much it feels like I'm letting go of that something, I don't know how to put it, but haven't found the sweet spot yet for very often.
Well, I'm glad that you're seeing it some of the time because that does gradually undermine it over time. Sometimes if you feel that you're in the control mode and you actually do you ever have a moment where you see that you're in control mode and you're just mindful of being there, but you haven't been able to let it go?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So one thing you can do when you get to that place is, if you can remember, is just ask the question, what else is present in experience? And that doesn't mean you're looking for like other thoughts or anything, but like you might notice that the feeling tone of control, trying to control, is actually unpleasant underneath. There's pleasure in the idea that we are controlling. It's like, okay, I got this, and that's pleasant, and that's what we're going for in this. But there's an underlying feeling tone actually of fear that you're not in control. And so it's not, I'm not trying to create any experience for you, but just like if you open up, the reason I'm saying that is that if you can feel that underlying unpleasant feeling tone, it demotivates the mind from wanting to do that. You have to see the disadvantage of the control-oriented state sometimes in order to be more willing to give it up. So this is a gentle approach, is just to make sure you open to the fullness of that experience and get the parts that are both pleasant and unpleasant.
Okay, so I had a whole online retreat, or home retreat, listening to tapes, and it was all about the control, and it got really, that make it happen temper tantrum place. So it, and then I had a whole past life review of control and all the ways control, not all, but a lot of the ways control showed up in my life. And so there was a great dissipation. So I think maybe now, as you were speaking, it's just to ask even, is control present? Just to be noticing
Yeah,
that.
that's great.
Because it's in the clinging and the aversion, right? That it's in the awareness of having gotten lost in thoughts and all that comes up, right? That the discipline,
Yeah.
and to be with that, in a way that doesn't add the suffering. Anyway, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, somewhere there's a belief that attempting to exert control is going to bring a good result for you. And
Right.
it probably it has in the past, and but not all the time, but enough of the time that you believe that. And so it's also a matter of seeing that belief when it's operating. Yeah, I love that you're seeing more and more of your mind. That's great. Okay. Oh, I look at the time. So we'll officially end.